or two in case anybody else is coming.
Hi, Penny.
There's Fanny. How is it down there in Key West, Nam Duck?
It's hot as usual and humid. It's not the heat that gets me. It's the humidity. My sister just called me from New York City. She said it's warm up there, but it's not as humid as it is down here. So she's very comfortable.
Well, you're surrounded by water, right?
Yeah. Hi, Fanny.
And D.C., and what I call old school D.C., is you wear a washcloth or a towel around your neck when you go out. So that's what I do.
I didn't know that was a thing in D.C. I haven't seen that in Richmond that I recall.
It's old. It's going out of, you know, as the city gets gentrified, it's no longer cool. Right.
Because everybody's got air conditioning, probably, all the new fancy people. It's landlocked here. Okay. Oh, yes, Annie's going to try that, right? And how are you, Richard? Oh, Richard.
I'm fine.
Okay, good. Is
Karma Trinley on here?
I invited him. He's not here.
I was looking through the pictures. I don't see him either. I was just wondering.
He said he forgets. If you want to give him a call and just see if he wants to come, you can, but I don't want to pressure him. He was interested. I sent him an invitation yesterday, I think.
Okay. Might be trying to get on or something.
Yeah.
He might come.
He what?
Are you asking me?
Oh, yeah. I didn't hear what you said that last thing.
I said he might come to the class, but he didn't say for sure.
Yeah. You know, that moment comes, and I know how that is.
I have it every morning when I wake up. I'm not going to do anything, you know.
I have that thought occasionally, but it never, I never follow through. All right, well, we're going to start then. We're going to do our prayers. Anybody got any questions or anything before we start the prayers? Okay, I guess I will mute everybody. Otherwise, we're going to have a train wreck. Okay. And you, as always, you can unmute yourself if you have anything to say or raise your hand. Excuse me. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru, four continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Dadan sam chen tam che lo chu su dro ar zin ji love to soul. Chu lam du dro ar zin ji love to soul. Lam trupa sa war zin ji love to soul. Trupa yi she su char war zin ji love to soul. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chin ke chul vom da da mi ke nam dang dro a kun chi dra ke jit sam pa tam che ke du da ki chi ten to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. When this prayer says demons, I'm not sure that's the correct translation, and someday I'm going to look it up. Usually comes across as a Sanskrit term, and I don't know what it is, and I haven't been able to find it. But I'm not sure it's really demons. But in the meantime, we'll just think, we hope that demons also are benefiting from our discussion today. So for everybody who has it, reminder for arousing bodhicitta at the beginning of teachings. And if you don't have it to read along with us, you can just arouse the thought in your mind. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation, the theme of our course, the first practice of a bodhisattva. So we will do our meditation, the two wings of awakening. You don't need to have the sheet, but you're welcome to, you know, pull it out if you want to follow along by reading. We're just going to do a short meditation on wisdom and compassion. So begin by just checking in with our posture. Everybody knows the posture. Just get comfortable and sort of stable and settled. And then we can check in with our body. I always like to start that way because we get so caught up in our thoughts and busyness and so forth. So just take a moment to just check in with your whole body at once, the whole, how your body feels, putting our attention into our body instead of just in our thoughts. And rest like that for a moment. Just feeling very grounded and present in our on our seat, in the space we're in, with all of these others who are joining us in cyberspace in this present moment. Eyes can be open or closed, whatever's more comfortable. So we begin by contemplating the four reminders very briefly, the precious human existence. We all know what that means. That's the first verse. Just appreciation and resolution. Like, part of this contemplation is to resolve that we're really going to make use of it. And then second, impermanence and death, which is our topic today. And karma, we are the captains of our fate. It is our own actions that determine our future. So we want to make them count, especially activities that lead towards liberation. And then the suffering of samsara. There is just no safe place in samsara. There's no use wishing and working for a better life, more money, better relationships, and so forth. They all bring suffering. So what we set our sights on as we step into our boat to navigate the endless sea of samsara towards the shore of complete awakening, we set our sights on freedom. So now that we are all fired up to do practice, we do some calm abiding meditation, just letting our minds come to rest further in preparation for the ultimate bodhicitta sequence. You can follow your breath or just rest in open awareness. just letting all thoughts go as they come in. Lightening up, loosening up. Letting the mind come to rest. And we begin the ultimate bodhicitta meditation by just letting go of the solidity of our current experience, physical, emotional, mental. Look at all experience as a dream. Just feel what it would feel like if what we're experiencing now, including all of our thoughts and opinions and judgments, if it were just a dream that we're going to wake up from. And then having let go a little bit of the solidity of our present experience, we then turn our attention inward to look at the nature of mind, examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn. We begin by asking ourselves one or two questions to help us tune into what the mind feels like. Again, it's not analysis, but you're just looking and feeling. So we could ask, does it have a color? A specific color, the mind. Is it located in a particular place inside or outside the body? And this process of looking has brought us into awareness of our awareness, and we let that go, which leaves us in just awareness. Rest in the essence, the basis of everything. Trungpa Rinpoche calls it home sweet home. He says we are talking very simply about the basis as just a clear mind, a basic clear mind, simplicity, clarity, not following thoughts. You can just come home and relax. The idea is to return to home, sweet home. So let's rest in home, sweet home for a couple moments. Concepts may arise as we rest here, and that's fine. Home has plenty of space for concepts to come and go. We just don't grasp onto them. So within this state of resting in the essence, resting in the simplicity of awareness, we begin the practice of taking and sending, alternately synchronizing with the breath, bringing anyone to mind that you know is suffering and that you wish not to suffer, any kind of suffering, whoever comes to mind, a person who's alive, a person who's died, an animal, an insect. And we just breathe in their suffering, and we can add the visualization of seeing it as dark smoke if that's helpful, that's optional. Breathing in that suffering into our heart center, our vast, open, spacious Buddha nature, and it dissolves. That's going to tie in with our study today. And when we breathe out, either every out-breath or every few out-breaths, this can be a very relaxed process. We breathe out to that person or group of people or animals, whatever they need, relaxation, happiness, peace, freedom from illness. And we continue that sequence, all the while continuing to rest in the essence. seeing the person or animal vividly and really thinking that we're really breathing in their suffering and freeing them from it, dissolving it. And they're receiving whatever they need to be completely happy and free. And then we could bring to mind, whether we know them or not, anyone else who's having that same kind of suffering. Suffering of having just died, the suffering of illness, the suffering of poverty or homelessness, whatever it is. The world is full of them. Breathing in all of their suffering, breathing out whatever they need. And now, expanding our visualization to include all sentient beings, all people on all continents, on all planets, all animals that fly in the air, all animals under the ground, all animals in the oceans, all invisible beings in the hell realms, the hungry ghost realm, the gods realm. Whatever suffering they have, we breathe it in. Let it dissolve. Breathe out the antidote. And now we let go. Well, first we think that everyone is freed from suffering, including ourselves, and all beings have attained complete freedom and awakening. That's from John Gong Hong Tro. And now, with everyone completely awakened, we can let go of any concepts and visualization. Just go back to following the breath or resting in open awareness. And now we'll come back to our class. You can stretch or think a few thoughts. Just take a little break. Get your mind ready for study and discussion. I saw Deidre come in briefly. I'm wondering if it's worth checking with her to see if she had any technical difficulty or just leave it to her with an email. I'm just going to check my email in case it could be Deidre. It's not. Okay. Turning off the sound. All right. Well, I think Deidre would have got in touch with us if she needed help. So. So anybody have any questions or thoughts they would like to share before we get to work?
I do. I have a confession. When I'm reading this prayer, when you get to this part about may I reach Buddhahood for beings?
Yeah.
My feeling is if I reached Buddhahood, I would be much better positioned to help everybody else. Yeah. And it's kind of like putting the cart before the horse, for my logic.
Well, you can't actually, the teaching in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation is that you can't actually reach Buddhahood if you don't do it for all beings. So it's just an aspiration. I think we can't all arrive there at the same time, probably. I'm not sure if this is addressing, like, your
issue with that. But reaching Buddhahood, it's like for the sake or for the benefit of all beings in order to help all other beings attain Buddhahood. So I think it's not really different from what you're saying. But
it feels different. You know, I feel like I'm not being sincere with that because it's really not how I feel.
So you feel, well, so you feel, what is it that you feel? Like
when you feel like I can't help anybody till I'm somewhere myself.
Yeah, that's the teaching too. But it's different. It's not, I think what you're saying is not quite the same as what the prayer is saying. It's not, I'm not sure exactly what you're envisioning here, but we're just aspiring to reach Buddhahood so that we will be in a position to effectively help all beings. That's all. It's like putting on the oxygen mask, you know, before you help the person next to you. But you put on your oxygen mask with the thought that now I'll be able to help that person. So does that help clear it up?
Yeah, sort of.
That's okay. This is something you can contemplate, you know. This is what we do with the Dharma, is like when we have a doubt or we have a question, we have to honor that. When we have a discomfort, we really have to honor that. So it's a good quest, Valerie.
Thank you, Lama.
Anybody else have a question or a comment or anything to share? Totally open forum here. Yes, John. I'm unmute. Oh, you can unmute yourself.
Sorry. Yeah. I ran into a question this week in a meditation group, and everything we're doing is geared towards someone who is invested and has a stake in the Dharma and in Buddhahood, achieving enlightenment. But what of those who want to meditate but are having, I mean, it's difficult enough if you've got, you know, contemplate impermanence and everything, but for those who are not of that mind, of that thought, what about them? They can't seem to find time. So I broke it down and said, all right, well, do little as much as you can in little smaller sessions. But then that gets turned into, that's the way to do it. And then they cheat on that from that level. And then it just keeps going. And then they really have a difficult time. Do you have any advice there?
Could you restate that? Like just yeah. Give that one more whirl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what advice would you give to a non-practitioner who wants to meditate and is having difficulty finding the time to do it without the discipline and the teachings that we have? So you tell, they're told, all right, well, we could do smaller sessions to make it more easy, you know, easier. But that, once you go down that road, then they take that as the norm, and then they cut back from there. They cheat on that.
Yeah.
And then it goes nowhere. So, I mean, without, you can't instill in someone to want to do this, and it's coming from them. So what do you do? Just introduce and be happy, you know, introduce and just be happy with whatever happens?
I think you have hit upon the exact solution. That's exactly it. You can present what you have to offer, but we have a saying, right? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him or her drink. And so we have to let it be that way. The horse is not thirsty at this moment, but what we can, you know, we can aspire on their behalf that eventually they will recognize that they need the water, but you can't make them thirsty if they're not. The whole first seven verses, actually, first, I say verses 2 through 6, two through five are about disentanglement. If somebody's not disentangled yet, it's going to be very hard for them to actually get down to work and practice because there's always more entanglements. You know, we don't have time or we'd rather do something else. It always comes down to that, I think. There's very few, I see your comment, Fanny, in just a sec. It always comes down to priorities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, I used to think I was too busy. But what was happening was I was just letting everything else take priority. And I was fitting in my Dharma practice if there was time left over. So what I had to do was turn that upside down for myself and go, okay, I'm doing Dharma practice from this time to this time, and then everything else gets to fit in. And lo and behold, you know, sometimes something fell off the map, but not a really important thing. If there's a crucial thing, then obviously I'm going to have to fit that in. Anyway, I could ramble on, but I think that's the exact thing, John. I think you're handling it exactly perfectly. Nothing else we can do.
Right. Okay,
and
thank you.
People come to you and complain that they just can't find time for Dharma practice, like it's something that you should solve for them. Like, give me another idea. Just give me another idea, because this is not working for me. And it's like,
yeah.
There's nothing else to offer.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Alrighty, Fanny says, I am finding that everything something to date is falling apart. A lot of fear and uncertainty professionally, personally are shaking my core. I am bold and can't quite access that. I think there might be a typo or two here, so I'm not 100% sure. I know that it's my journey now and to be here for my mom. Welcome all the support, feeling a lot of loneliness. Well, glad you can be here with us, Fanny. Samsara is really not easy to navigate. That's why we need to be in that boat, because it does help us. And so I'm glad you can be here in the Dharma community, because obviously you have lost, you know, being in the midst of a Dharma community that you could access in person easily with your move on behalf of your mother. So you are living the Bodhisattva, you know, ideal of sort of sacrificing some of your own self-interest to help someone else. And that's huge. Yes, Marilyn, let me unmute you. All right.
I was just reading parts of your blog, and perhaps, I don't know whether this is useful for Fanny or not, but if she can get to the part of your blog where you're talking about taking care of your mother.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, because it's really about letting go, which I found very, very useful, but maybe it'll be helpful. It's not exactly the same thing, but
yeah,
maybe.
Well, we do that. I mean, you know, Fanny, that I left the monastery. Same thing. I left my home at the monastery to come to Richmond and take care of my mother, who had Alzheimer's. And it's very hard. It's really, really hard. And you've lost that immediate access to your community as well. But everything is impermanent. You know, your situation, every situation is impermanent as well. So you're sort of making the most of your time with your mom and helping her to have as good a quality of life as she can. And that's what bodhisattvas do. So just keep in touch and let us know how we can support you, okay? All right, anybody got anything else? All right, so then we will, oh, silent pop quiz, we must have that. Just first four practices, can you list them in your mind? Just not the verses, but just the names. All right. So we're going to now turn to the verses. I'm going to do a screen share, and we're going to chant the verses together, and there's your answer. I think it's worthy of aspiring, as I say every class, worthy of aspiring to just know what the practices are. There's a story that I read a few years ago about Khandro Rinpoche, you know, the female Nyingma Lama, who, she has a center in Virginia that I've never been to. I think it's closer to D.C., that some student saw her, like, it had been to a seminar she gave, a teaching she gave, like a whole course she gave on the 37 practices of a bodhisattva. And he came to see her like the next year. And he said, oh, I was at your class. And he said, and she said, so what are the 37 practices? And she waited for an answer. She wanted to know what they were. He didn't have them like right at hand. But I'll bet if you could get through like the first four, she would stop you. So at least learn the first seven. Let's know the preliminaries. All right, I'm going to share the screen and we'll chant together. Okay. Have we got it? Can people see it? Thumbs up. Okay. If anybody can't see it, unmute yourself and let me know. Okay, let's go down to the right. Okay. All right, we're going to chant them all one time, and then we'll do verse 4 three times, because that's the one we're on. So number one, to study, contemplate, and meditate. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And again, if possible, it can be, it's so easy to just chant words and not be connected with the meaning. Let's try to really feel the meaning of these. Number two, to leave my homeland. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Number three, practice number three, to rely on solitude. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And then the verse for this week, to let go of attachment to this life, this lifetime. Practice number four, on the road to disentanglement. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And we're going to recite that one twice more, again, trying to keep up with the meaning as we chant it. I'll chant a little slower. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And one more time. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So, any thoughts? It's not easy giving up attachments and disentangling ourselves. It takes a steady effort. And sometimes we lose it a bit, and sometimes we have to get it back, you know, back on track. It's not easy. I mean, I just was with, you know, our Sangha member who passed away recently, after being ill with ovarian cancer for 5.5 years. And it was a very slow process of disentanglement, you know, of just the pain of knowing that she was going to die. Like, she was just putting it off. And then getting closer and closer, and when treatment didn't work anymore, and so on and so forth. So it's work. It's good work if we can do a lot of it before we get sick. Because when you're sick, when you know death is coming, there's actually a lot to think about. It really occupies your mind. So we're really lucky to have this precious human life and this opportunity to, you know, start to give up our habits and reactions and find our solitary place and our silence to engage with the Dharma. And through that, to start giving up our attachments that when we are dying are going to cause us a lot of suffering. So we're going to look at the commentaries today. They're all good. We've now attained solitude, right? We all are appreciating that in order to travel this path, we got to carve out that time, that solitary time to actually engage with practice. Even if it's only 5 minutes, it really counts. And so now the work begins of actually disentangling ourselves, of seeing where we're attached. And believe me, if we're looking, we will see that like constantly in our face, all the places we're attached in positive and negative ways. I mean, attachment in this context, here it's really talking about sort of positive things. We're really happy to have friends and family, generally. Happy to have wealth and possessions. We're happy to have our consciousness, like our body, inhabited by our mind. But it also, attachments can also be negative, like things that we have aversion to. I mean, that eats up a lot of our energy as well. So we're trying to cut through now in whatever ways we can, whatever is holding us to samsara, whatever is entrenching us in samsara. So in the commentary by Dingo Chense Rinpoche, I had a dream last night that I got a teaching from Dingo Chense Rinpoche. Of course, when I woke up, I had no idea. Like, I couldn't remember a thing. But I actually saw him in my dream, which was very lovely. I don't dream about teachers all that often that I remember. So it was Dingo Chense. I don't think I ever dreamed about him before. So we must be really in the trenches here with him. Maybe we'll all have some dreams about him. Another great chapter on page 69. Another great chapter. We're not this week going to try to read the whole chapter. Most of you won't, because I want to get to Ken's commentary. And I also want to get to Pema Chodron's, like my notes from Pema Chodron, because they're very helpful as well. I don't know if anybody's noticed that I actually have already posted, you know, my class notes on this verse, which I will add to if, you know, depending on what we talk about in class. But we're just going to hit some highlights here. And again, unmute yourself or raise your hand anytime you have something you want to say, and I'll allow some spaces as well. So so I added to the blog the verse that I translated that we chant at KTC every other day in the morning service, which is about this. It's about what, like when you detach yourself from the solidity of your perceptions, which make us react to things as if they're permanent. You know, I got to have this job. You know, I've got to have this friend. I've got to have this car. I've got to have this dress, you know, or whatever it is, this ice cream. They're gone. Like, especially the ice cream is just gone in a flash. It's like, okay, where was that? Like, what have I got now? Nothing. So there's this lovely verse that is in my blog. It's in my blog now, and I'm gonna just chant you my translation of it. It's how the Buddha instructed in the Diamond Sutra, how he instructed all of us to look at all of our experience, to relate to all of our experience. And it's very pithy. It's easy to memorize, and I chant it every day at least once. So it's all the metaphors for how things really are. So it goes, flickering stars and candle flames, illusions, water bubbles, streams, dewdrops, clouds, a lightning flash, you all composite things like this. So all the examples, like what is our life really like? It's like a flash of lightning. What is that ice cream? It's like dew that dries, like when the sun comes up. like an illusion. It's like a water bubble. None of them last long, and none of them are really solid things that you could grasp onto. So that's the way our experience really is. So that's not in the commentary here, but I kind of added that to what we can use as one of our tools to think about impermanence. So he then has the four N's. He lists the four N's, which is a very classic way to express impermanence. This must be the Nyingma version. It's different from the one that we usually see in the Kagyu lineage. I'm going to read his on page 69. Whatever is born will die. We put that last in our version. Whatever is born will die. Whatever is gathered will disperse. Whatever is accumulated will come to exhaustion, and whatever is high will fall. And if we look at our experience, we see again and again and again the truth of all of these things. Whoever is born definitely dies. There's a good bit of explanation of that in the Torch of Certainty. That's one of the five like ways to think about impermanence is everybody who's ever been alive either has died or you know that they're going to. Like it's not going to change suddenly for some one person. Like it's that they're not going to die. Everybody's always died. Whatever is gathered will disperse. So all that money in the bank, like it's so easy for that to just disappear. Everything, dandelions, you know, the nice yellow flower, and then you have the puffy sort of seed thing. And then the wind blows and it's all gone, all over, to spread more dandelions. Whatever is accumulated will come to exhaustion. That's the bank account. Whatever is high will fall. The version that we have that I'm more familiar with is whatever is accumulated. The end, so it's called the four ends and it always starts with the end. The end of accumulation is scattering. The end of building or construction is ruin. All buildings that are built, even when the Maitreya Center was in the last stages of being built, I was walking through it with Lama Norla one day through the construction because he was coming from the retreat house and I was escorting him back to the house. And he said, this will be a ruin one day. Even the Maitreya Center will be, you know, we're building it now. We're all excited about it. It's going to be, one day it's just going to be ruined. It's going to be like fall apart. So the end of construction is ruin. The end of, what's left? The end of, I don't have it in front of me. It's in Ken. The end of accumulation is scattering. The end of building is ruin. The end of something is something, and the end of earth is death. Sorry, slipping my mind at the moment. But we're going to encounter it again in Kent's translation. But anyway, the point is, this is also the way we look at all composite phenomena. Like, this doesn't actually apply to everything. It applies to what we call composite or conditioned phenomena, which is anything that comes together of parts, anything that's made of parts, which is pretty much everything we encounter. Space is like a counterexample. Space is not a composite phenomenon or a conditioned phenomenon, and space does not end. But everything else, everything that we can put our hands on, comes to an end in one way or another. And so he goes through, this is actually Gompopa's chapter on impermanence, is very lovely and very complete, comprehensive way to contemplate impermanence. So if you have the Jewel Ornament of Liberation or Ornament of Precious Liberation, either of those translations, I recommend that you read the chapter on impermanence. And he goes through very similar examples. Here, Dingo Chensei Rinpoche talks about how the seasons change. Like right now, the grass is sort of turning brown from the heat. But most things are green and there's lots of fruit at the farmer's market and all that. And then fall will come and everything will change color. So Gompopa, I'm going to go with Gompopa here because it's a little more sort of comprehensive than Dingo Chensei's examples. So he says there are three things to look at. He says there's two basic kinds of impermanence. One is gross impermanence and one is subtle impermanence. Gross impermanence is that world systems come and go. You know, I mean, this our solar system one day will blink out or explode or what, however it's going to go. You know, and it goes into some details about how world systems can, sometimes they're destroyed by fire and sometimes they're destroyed by water. But even world systems, whole galaxies, whole perhaps universes, come into existence and go out of existence, you know, billions of years later. But so we can't really look at that kind of impermanence unless maybe we're an astronomer. I think they might get some view of that, like stars that become extinguished or and new stars, nova stars. But the thing we can look at is what's called subtle impermanence. And it goes from, like, it includes some very subtle and some not so subtle. And he gives three examples of it, of things that we can actually pay attention to that are like a hook for us to keep impermanence in mind. And the first one is day and night. Like every 24 hours, we have two chances. Every 12 hours, we have a chance to really notice, like remember impermanence, because the sun rises and it's day, and then the sun sets and it's night. And it's worth really paying attention to that. Notice when the sun sets and you go, okay, another day is over and it's night. And then the next morning you get up and it's like, okay, another night is over and it's day. Second example is the one that Dingo Chense Rinpoche used here, which is the seasons. Like really tune into the seasons. I'm always, for some reason, very sensitive to midsummer. There's a little bit of wistfulness about it because, I mean, I like all the seasons. Even winter's not too bad, especially I loved it in New Hampshire, but summer comes, like spring comes, and it's just, you're so glad that winter's over, really. You got some warm weather, and things grow, and there's berries in the market, and all that, and then the summer goes on, and suddenly it's the middle of summer, and I'm always sort of pay attention to that turning point. I don't think we've quite hit it. We're awfully right on top of it now, where suddenly summer is waning and you're like, autumn is coming, winter is coming. It's like the crickets get louder and a certain flowers bloom. Like here it's Joe Pieweed for me. That's the one. It's like, okay, it's the middle of summer now. In up north it was Loose Strife, which is a purple flower that we don't have in the south, that like you see whole fields of loose strife and you go, okay, summer's heading to an end now. So we can pay attention to those things. You know, cooler breeze means, okay, autumn is coming. The leaves are starting to change. We just have reminders all around us. And then the third one is the most subtle, and it's called moment-to-moment impermanence. And it's just noticing things change from moment to moment. You know, if you sit out, it seems like I like to sit out in the backyard under the trees where hopefully there's a little breeze and it's even in hot weather, it's kind of comfortable and watch the clouds. Or if you just sit still for a while, which we hardly ever do in our lives, mostly if you do it outside or in front of a window, you see so much, like so much is going on every minute. Like this bird's flying this way and the little chipmunk runs across the asphalt, and there's so much activity happening, but it's just constant change. You know, you feel like sitting down because you've been busy, and then you feel like getting up because you've been sitting. Moment to moment to moment to moment, like every single moment is changed. I'm watching Richard's fan go around. You know, it's like, it's not static. It's like, it's just moving constantly. That's moment-to-moment impermanence. So the more we tune into these three examples, the more we keep impermanence in mind for ourselves. So what else do we have here? I wanted to look at this lovely quote. This is one of my favorite quotes. I think it's in the Ornament of Precious Liberation as well, on page 71. On page 70, though, he says, like, after talking about the seasons changing, he says, "The same is true of people. We change with every passing moment." And as you get older, you start to get wrinkles, like your face starts to change, whatever. You really become tuned in to moment to moment to moment. It's like, oh my God, another change, another sign of old age has crept in since yesterday. So we change with every passing moment. We change minute by minute from youth to old age and from old age to death. Our opinions, ideas, and plans are constantly changing and evolving. like a month ago, what did you think you wanted to be doing like now? And are you doing it, or have your ideas completely changed already? If you really tune into your mind. So outside we can sit and watch nature changing, the clouds moving, like cars going by, everything changing constantly. When we sit in our solitary place and meditate and quiet our mind, what we see changing is our thoughts. So we just see that parade of thoughts and images, and changes of feeling, hot to cold, cold to hot, restless to settled, settled to restless. And the thoughts going by and constantly, like you can't hold one thought in your mind, even if you try, you really can't. Your mind is onto something else. So there's just, we can just tune into impermanence in so many different ways. And now here's, like, I'm remembering on page 71, there's a verse from Jigme Lingpa, who was a great Nyingma Tertön, like he found hidden texts and teachings, very big thing in the Nyingma lineage. And I've seen this verse before, and it's so appropriate right now. We called it wishing our life away when I was a kid. I remember people saying that to me. I haven't heard it in a while, but like, you can't wait for Christmas to come because you're like 6 years old and you just want it to be Christmas tomorrow. And your aunt says, wishing your life away. And you don't know what that means. But Jigme Lingpa knows what it means. And he says, people who have sweltered in the summer's heat. Let's think a moment. Are we doing that right now? People who have sweltered in the summer's heat rejoice at the clear, cool light of the autumn moon. But they are not frightened at the thought that 100 days of their lives have passed and gone. So this is more about like when autumn actually comes, we're joyful that that time has passed. And we don't think, oh my God, I've lost 3 months of my precious human existence. Like death is 3 months closer now than it was when I was sweltering. But I hear people say quite a lot, and I think this thought myself sometimes, oh gosh, I can't wait for autumn. Like it is so hot. I just can't wait for those cool breezes and, you know, colorful leaves and all that. And you're giving your life away. It's like, you need to use those 3 months. Like even if you're sweltering, we need to appreciate every moment that we have. Or as Dingo Chense says, life is as evanescent as dew on the tip of a blade of grass. That's one of those examples from the verse, flickering stars and candle flames, illusions, water bubbles, streams, dewdrops, clouds, a lightning flash. You all composite things like this. Nothing can stop death, just as no one can stop the lengthening shadows cast by the setting sun. That's the other thing you notice right now at the turn of summer, like after the solstice, is the days are getting longer. Night is coming sooner. So let me see if there's anything else here. Yeah, there's a couple of things. Page 72 and 73, there's a couple of verses. So Jawa Gutsangpa on page 72 said, and Gutsangpa, he's the master who wrote the song, who sang the song that we sometimes, that Kenpo Tsultrum used to teach us. It's about, I can't remember the song, but it's along the same lines as actually, this is from Tokme Zangpo, our current teacher, that's quoted in Great Path of Awakening. If getting well is more beneficial, may I get well. It's when you're sick. If being ill is more beneficial, may I be ill. If death is more beneficial, may I die. That's Gutsangpa. He thinks about these things a lot, obviously. It's in one of the Shempen Ösals. I'll try to find that, you know, that reference, because it's a lovely song. It's so helpful when you're actually sick. But anyway, Gutsangpa here says, meditate on death and impermanence, and you will sever ties to your homeland. Entangling attachments to your relatives and craving for food and wealth. I mean, we've covered three preliminaries right here. It's impermanence is the thing that cuts through entanglement. Realizing that everything that we're craving is going to come to an end. Everything, all of our relatives and friends and loved ones are going to disappear from our lives in one way or another. If we just meditate on death and impermanence, we will sever ties to our homeland, entangling attachments to our relatives and craving for food and wealth. So this is how important meditating on impermanence is. Two verses on page 73. I'm finding the verses very helpful in this chapter. As is said, so we don't know who this is attributed to, we ought to fear death now and thus become fearless at the time of death, but instead we are careless now. We don't think about death at all. We're careless because it's not right in front of us. And then when death arrives, we will beat our breast in anguish. So if we think about death and impermanence now, it will lessen our suffering at the time that we're actually dying. If we start to, I see you, Richard, are you, did you want to say something? All right, let me unmute you.
I was trying to say it a minute ago, so it makes more
sense.
When I meditate that way on things that I love or like,
yeah,
they become more precious, especially living things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't detach. I actually cling more. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I wonder, though, if there's a distinction there. I mean, you may cling more, but you may also just be appreciating the preciousness more, which is something that goes with being aware of impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
Like understanding the preciousness, and then you kind of appreciate it in the moment. Like you don't get into meaningless fights with people when you really appreciate that they're there now and they won't be in the future.
Yeah. I'm thinking of my cat, of course, but
yeah,
I would look at him and think he's going to die someday, you know, and
yeah,
all he's going to rot and, you know, all this stuff. And it would just make me feel more close to him, not distant.
Well, detachment is not the same as distance. And this is a really important point, and we've hit on it before and it's something we have to keep coming back to because it's not the way our minds work. I'll get to you in a minute, John. I see that your hand is raised. It's not raised. Okay, it says on my screen that it is, so I will just erase that. Oh gosh, there was the train of thought. Detachment, disentanglement is not the same as indifference. It's not distance or indifference. It can even be a way of being closer and more aware and just appreciating more. So we don't want to go to that extreme. It's not giving up our feelings. It's just giving up. What is it giving up? It's giving up the idea that something will last forever.
Yeah.
And then we don't get the shock. I was going to use this last week. Some of you may have heard it. Nyingi Rinpoche's Man in the Lion Suit. Is anybody who doesn't know that story? Because I won't tell it if everybody knows it. Okay, well, so Nyingi Rinpoche, and I think this is relevant to your question, Richard. So the first time Nyingi Rinpoche taught at KTC, this was like his first teaching tour ever, and it's because Sita Rinpoche could not leave India. This was when he first couldn't leave India, and he sent Nyingi Rinpoche in his stead to teach. And KTC was one of the few places that he came. Now he has this whole network of monasteries, but we still see him from time to time. Anyway, first time he came, 2002, gosh, I'm thinking that Anne and Jeffrey might have been there for that teaching.
I was there.
And Marilyn, and yeah. Well, anyway, one of the things that stuck in my mind is the man in the lion suit. And it's possible it wasn't the very first teaching or visit that he told it, but it was one of the very early visits. He said, okay, so imagine that you're going from one room into another room. You know, you're in your house and you're going from one room to another room. Maybe there's a party going on. And so the room that you're entering, like behind the open door, there is lurking a man in a lion suit. And so as you come through the door, the man in the lion suit jumps out and scares you, and you almost have a heart attack. And then you realize it's not really a lion, and you're not really going to be eaten. It's just a man pretending to be a lion in a lion suit. So he said, it's really helpful to know beforehand that the man in the lion suit is there, and that he can't really destroy you. So that's why we study the four thoughts. He was talking about the four thoughts. This is why we study the four thoughts. It's all suffering, karma, death, we're going to die, impermanence. We think about those things now. We familiarize ourselves with that man in the lion suit, because if we don't, then it's going to really shock us when it comes. But if we think about it before, it will be okay. And we'll know, like, death is really not the end of everything. Like, it's not the end of my mind in some sense. It's just the end of my body. So I forget why now. I thought that that was really relevant to your story. But yeah, I don't know.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Well, anyway, it's a good story. It's a really good example. This is so we remember that all of our loved ones are going to die, and thinking about it somehow is helpful. But it doesn't mean that we need to emotionally detach from them. We just need to let go of our emotional grasping, thinking that. So I guess that's the reason, is that sometimes whatever it is that we're attached to, that attachment depends on always having it. You know, that's what attachment is, believing that it's always going to be there for you and that it should always be there for you. And it's not fair if something happens and you don't have it anymore. But if we accustom ourselves to that beforehand, then it's still sad when the person or the cat dies or moves away or whatever it is that happens. It's still really sad, and you get to feel that grief. You knew it was coming, and so it doesn't hit you. It doesn't destroy you in that moment. You knew it was coming, and you could prepare for it, and you could help them through it, you know, whatever positive things you could do. So that's why I told the story.
Mama?
Yes, Mary.
Also, I always think with these things that, like, when I die, I'll think of all the things that I loved that went before me. So they did it, I could do it.
Yes, I think that way too. Yes, actually, when I was going through this with my friend Scarlett, our Sangha member here, she was like such an example. And I was always like, this is the way I want to be when I know I'm dying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Namdak.
I have a little problem. I used to suffer from deep depression, which I take antidepressants for, and now I feel fine. But mm-hmm. I had times where I really felt like I wanted to die. So consequently, I really have very little fear of death. No matter how much I meditate on impermanence and samsara, I kind of okay with dying. I know I may feel differently when I'm on my deathbed, but I really don't know what to do about that except continue meditating on impermanence and samsara, but it doesn't seem really to be helping.
Well, no, you mean you think you should be afraid of impermanence and death?
Should be afraid of death, yeah.
No, Milarepa said, I can't remember, I wish I could remember the exact quote. There's a famous quote from Milarepa that something to the effect that he turned to the Dharma because he was afraid of death. And through practicing the Dharma, he's no longer afraid. He lost all of his fear of dying. Not being afraid of dying is good. But the reason that we need to be, when the texts say we should be afraid of impermanence and afraid of dying, it means we should take them seriously. It's that fear that makes us turn to the Dharma. You're already a Dharma practitioner. It seems like maybe it's helped you. Maybe the antidepressants helped too. I don't know. But I think the Dharma, it's the man in the lion suit again. The more you confront it, like honestly, before you're caught up in it, the less frightening it is, I think. I think that's true. I mean, I can't say I'm not at all afraid of death. I'm more like afraid of like pain, like horrible, intractable pain or something. But they can, you know, they can do a lot for those things now. People don't die in such pain in our culture usually. Death itself, you know, I'm like with Woody Allen, you know. I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Yeah, pain is also what I'm mostly afraid of, having a miserable death.
Yeah.
But the actual dying.
It sounds to me, Namdak, like you're a longtime Dharma practitioner. And that is the fruit of Dharma practice, is that you're actually less afraid, or ideally not afraid, of whatever comes next, whether it's death or losing your mortgage, you know, whatever adversity it is. We, as Dharma practitioners, we know to bring that on the path. So once you know to bring everything on the path and that it's all fuel for awakening, nothing's so scary. Probate, still a little scary, but I've worked my way through a lot of that. You know, I'm at the point where I have to set up a trust now for my brother as part of my mom's will. And it's like, okay, I can do this. I've been through probate. I can do the next thing. So, anyway, thanks for sharing that, Namdak and Valerie. Anybody got anything else? Marilyn, yes, I'm going to unmute you.
This is all about attachment to big things. My issue is that now that I've established a regular time to meditate, which I have had avoided because now that I'm retired, I didn't want to be, you know, stuck to a schedule. What I do is think about things that I have to do. I'm attached to the thoughts of I have to do this, I have to do that, we're going to go away next week, I got to do that, or attached to things like that bad movie that I saw or the fact that the squirrels chased away the feral cat and the feral cat didn't get to eat. I mean, teensy tiny things, but to me, they really still are attachment. And so yeah. I spent half an hour thinking about these things every morning.
As you're meditating or before? Yeah. Okay. Well, so that's your work in meditation is to let go. Like, let the thoughts come and then you just let the thoughts go again and again and again as they come up. That's just the work. But yeah, this is the work. This is what we do. We all have all of those little things. That's like the habits and reactions. That's our homeland, is to have, to be caught up in all of that. And that's the homeland we're actually learning to leave. You still have to take care of things. You know, you still do what you can for the feral cat. I know your cats, your feral cats. We still do what we can, but you know, it's just life. The raccoon eats the chipmunk. You know, it's like, okay, that's the way samsara works. You feel sad for the little chipmunk. You've been feeding it peanuts for like months. The raccoon ate it. That's what raccoons do.
I guess I'm a little perturbed that what was supposed to be a good practice, establishing the same time every day, is turning out not to be so much fun. And it was much
You just used two adjectives that we could talk about. Good, it was supposed to be good. Well, it still is. I mean, this is good that you're like looking at all of these things. This is just awareness. This is not that it hasn't made you have more of the thoughts. It's like you're just more aware. That's what I think. You may think differently. I don't know. I mean, you may perceive it differently, and we could talk about that. But it's all, there is no bad meditation experience. And Pema Chodron talks a lot about that, how busy her mind is. Her mind is never free of thoughts, she says. So she just watches the parade of thoughts. So the work of meditation when we have a busy mind is just to look at them all and not to get caught. You know, it's like, okay, you see that the squirrel has chased away the feral cat or whatever. You could spend like a half hour on that. And maybe you do. But the work of meditation is to notice, okay, I've gotten carried away by this thought, which I can actually think about later if I need to think about it. So I'm going to pull myself back to following the breath or whatever I'm doing. And it comes back and you do it again and you do it again. You get to the end of your meditation session 45 minutes later and you're still thinking about it, but you noticed it like 16 times. That's a triumph. We're not making our minds quiet. We are not trying to make our minds quiet. We're absolutely not. We're tuning our awareness to be aware of whatever is going on in our mind and keep ourselves from getting completely hooked into it. But I don't know if this is helpful or not to say these things.
Thank you.
But the other word you used was fun. It's not going to be fun. Sometimes it is. Sometimes meditation is like the funnest thing you can do. I think I have a blog post about that. It's called The Most Fun You Can Have. It's about meditation, which is once you just get the hang of it. Like, it's not supposed to be quiet and it's not supposed to feel good. It's just like whatever it is, you just stay with it. There's nothing better than that, but it doesn't always feel like fun because sometimes what's in your mind is unpleasant or upsetting. We don't try to make it otherwise. So you're just there whether it feels good or it feels bad, whether it's fun or whether it's torture, you're staying with it. And that's meditation. And so it's a triumph if you can do that. And if you can even have any observations about what's happening in your mind, that's a triumph. And I wish all the best for your feral cats. Did somebody else have something? I feel like there was somebody else who maybe had something they wanted to say. All right. Somebody? Did somebody say something? Marilyn, are you mute or unmute? You want to be muted? Okay, I'm muting me. All right, well, I don't see any hands raised. Sean, I felt like you had your hand raised and I was gonna get to you. No? Okay, well, never mind, that's just me. Okay, so we have a few minutes left. We're gonna do a meditation at the end, a short meditation. And meanwhile, there's Ken's commentary. We're gonna look at that very briefly. A lot of you have that one, so you can read it on your own. But, and I have this in my blog. If you don't have Reflections on Silver River, I have this meditation in my blog. So for in the class notes for this week, the study is to read the commentaries again. Like, keep reading about impermanence. Read the Jewel Ornament chapter on impermanence. Read whatever you can on impermanence. Don't let go of that. Keep that in your repertoire because we need the reminders. The contemplation for this week is this contemplation from Ken McLeod, and it can be very quick. It doesn't have to be a prolonged thing, but you might want to come back to it a few times during the week and forever after. He says, consider for a moment. So we're sitting or we're washing the dishes. You could do it anytime. Consider for a moment that you could die at any moment. You could die in the next minute, today or tomorrow, or months or years down the line, but it could be 5 minutes from now. Does your body tense up or does it relax? Or does something else happen? So we allow ourselves that image, that thought, that we could die any minute now. We could even think like the ceiling fan crashes down on us. As Laman Orla once said, he didn't worry about that. And somebody asked Laman Orla one time when he was sitting under the ceiling fan in the old shrine room at KTC, like, how do you deal with impermanence? Like, aren't you afraid all the time? And he said, well, I always keep impermanence in mind, but I never worry about the ceiling fan falling on my head, even though it could. But here we're thinking the ceiling fan could crash down on us. We could walk out in front of a bus. We could have a heart attack. Like, anything could happen. We could drown suddenly in our bathtub with no warning. What does that make you feel? So he's just suggesting we tune into that. How do you feel at the thought that you could die any minute now? Does your body tense up or relax? We're just observing. There's no right answer here. Or does something else happen? Like, what happens? What feelings arise at the thought of imminent death? Fear or relief? Anger or longing? Guilt, hope, resignation, or equanimity? So I suggest that we all do that exercise. We're not going to do it this minute, but on your own sometime as a way to bring... That's bringing contemplation. That's a particular kind of, like, almost a meditation, somewhere between contemplation and meditation. But just bringing it into, this is the man in the lion suit. We're actually walking through that door and letting the man in the lion suit jump out at us just so we can feel what it feels like. Like, what is our reaction? He says, even a little reflection along these lines brings up strong reactions. Your body does everything it can to stay alive. When your life is threatened, it reacts strongly. Fear and panic seize you. Fight, flee, or freeze. The basic survival tactics take over. Even when you face other kinds of death, the end of a relationship or the loss of your job, the same mechanisms run. You are conditioned to live biologically and psychologically. Now, you know you are going to die, but you do not believe it. We know we could theoretically die at any moment, but we don't think it's going to happen. We're making plans for like next month, next year. We're signing up for a class, you know, 6 months from now. You ignore the fact that death is inevitable. You focus your time and energy on the conventional concerns, meaning the eight worldly concerns. For these are what give meaning to most people's lives. Like, when you don't take into account that you could die, like, you just get very sucked into all of the normal samsaric stuff. He quotes a poem by Robinson Jeffers, which I really like here, so I'm going to read this. He says, this is Robinson Jeffers, the poet, speaking. Only tormented persons want the truth. Man is like other animals. And he's from like the 1950s or something, so he's going to be a little bit, you know, 1950s-ish gender-wise. Man is like other animals, wants food and success and women. Not truth. only if the mind, tortured by some interior tension, has despaired of happiness, then it hates its life cage and seeks further. So only in extremis, only when the bad thing happens, do we naturally turn towards, is this all there is? Isn't there some more meaning to life? So the whole point of this contemplation is, let's do it now. Let's not wait until the bad thing happens and we can't get our bearings, but let's get our bearings now that this is all going to happen. Nothing is permanent. He says, give up your life. That is Tokme Zangpo's instruction, but Ken says, give up your life. Give it all up. Do not base your life on what can be taken away from you. Wealth, possessions, health, family, friends, fame, respect, even your own life, being alive. If you have the good fortune to have family, friends, wealth, or respect, savor them, knowing that they must all come to an end sooner or later. But do not base your life on holding on to them. So what do we do if we're not holding on to all that stuff? He says, instead, do what life calls for in each moment, and do so without any gaining idea, meaning, that's a Zen term, meaning any idea of like it bringing you to some better place. Just whatever your life is at this moment, whatever your experience is at this moment, just do that. And don't be worrying about the future or whether you're going to lose the thing or whatever. Just do what is in front of you. Appreciate what's in front of you. Appreciate what you have, but don't grasp onto it. And that is the teaching. I want to take a couple of minutes. I want to get to the meditation soon, but I just want to read you a little bit from Pema Chödrön, from her commentary on this, because it's really helpful. And again, I have some of it in my blog post, my class notes, as a meditation for this week. She says, don't spend all your time attaching to things that are impermanent. That's like the summary of this verse, like this whole thing. Don't spend all your time attaching to things that are impermanent. Look at your life and see that we do that all the time. And then see how you can not do that. You can appreciate it. You can love it to death. You can just love it dearly. But don't attach to it in the sense that you just can't go on if you lose it. That's what that means. Know that it's going to go. So she says, instead, connect with what is unchanging. What is it that doesn't change? That's a good question, worth exploring. It's not just about death, not at all. And here we get into what I put in the class notes as a meditation. Trungpa Rinpoche, her teacher, in the 1970s gave a retreat called Death in Everyday Life. Nice, cheerful title, says Pema Chödrön. The teaching was, every breath is a birth and a death. It freaked me out, says Pema Chödrön. I think he was trying to convey the message that you can prepare for this big event, like the ultimate reminder of impermanence, like our death. You can prepare for it, the death of this body. But we also need to know that it's actually happening all the time, and we could get used to it and enjoy the ride. She says, it made me feel groundless, like nothing to hold on to. Each breath disappears, never to be seen again. So the meditation and the class notes is to, sometime when we're sitting on our meditation seat or walking or whatever we do, if we're meditating by following the breath, bring that into it, that awareness, just for a moment or two, that each time you breathe out, it's like a little death. Each time you breathe in, you're breathing in life. And each time you breathe out, it's going. I think it's quite lovely, actually, and a meditation that's always available to us. Even our breath is impermanent. And the definition of death, at least in Buddhism, is like when you breathe out and then you don't breathe in the next time. Like, that's it. So it's like, in a way, it's all about the breath. So she says, it doesn't feel all that wonderful to think about this, but you could open to that uneasy feeling. Again, as Buddhists, we want to wake up. We don't want to shut off experiences. We don't want to be in denial that something is unpleasant. We don't want to turn away and try to avoid it because it's unpleasant. So she says, you could open to that uneasy feeling. In the course of this brief human life, you could use your time to get comfortable with this understanding. It's not comfortable to give up attachment. She has taught extensively on shenpa. That's the Tibetan word for giving up attachment. Somebody have something to say, Valerie?
Yeah, couldn't you sort of cultivate your mind that death is going to be like really good?
You could. You could. It's like the greatest opportunity of our entire life, according to the teachings. It's our best chance to become enlightened on the spot. By, you know, our aware, if we die in a state of awareness, then that awareness, called the child awareness, meets the mother awareness, which is the big all-encompassing awareness. And if we don't go unconscious on ourselves and get all like scared and emotional and angry and upset and all that, but if we go in maintaining that awareness, then we naturally meet that awareness and merge with that huge awareness. And apparently that's a very wonderful thing. So yes, we could. But most people, and this is for most people, these teachings are for people who don't think about impermanence or are in denial about it. And we don't have to be in denial about it. And in the end, yes, that's like the most, sort of the most evolved, I guess, way of thinking of death, is that it's this fabulous opportunity. And that's what Tibetan Buddhism thinks. That's what Vajrayana Buddhism thinks, or Buddhism maybe thinks. You spend your whole life preparing for this opportunity to merge with full awakening at the moment you leave your body. So she says she teaches extensively on Shempa, the feeling of being hooked or activated, triggered, something gets you going. This is like when we forget impermanence, like every little thing bothers us. Every trivial little thing is huge in our mind and permanent and big and solid. So she says, give up the Shempa, that hooked, triggered feeling. Give up the Shempa to this life, this getting hooked and triggered, activated and traumatized again and again by the dynamic, fluid, alive quality of life that feels very threatening when we're used to trying to find something to hold on to and clinging to it with all our might. Instead of that, we could accustom ourselves to being in a river rather than on solid ground. It's like always moving. There is nothing to hold on to. It never stops. We are always hurtling towards death every moment of our life. So that each day of our life, we could become more familiar with that, getting our nervous system used to being uncomfortable and insecure. When it's no longer a threat, it just becomes an aspect of being human, an aspect of our life, that it is going to end, that everything is impermanent, that we're going to lose everything, new things are going to come in, we're going to have to get used to new things. Like, that's just the flow of life. And so at the beginning, when we tend to be in denial about that, it feels very uncomfortable to think about it, and we don't want to. But the more we allow that in, the more we think there's a man in a lion suit behind the door and I'm going to walk through it and he's going to jump out at me and it's going to startle me, the less startled you're going to be. It's like, oh, it's just the man in the lion suit. Oh, it's just death. You know, it happens to everybody. It's a great opportunity to become enlightened. So anyway, there's a little more to it, but we're pretty much out of time now. I just wanted to say, because I do want to do some meditation, I just wanted to say I also looked at Kempo Sultan Jangso Rinpoche's commentary on this verse. And I'm always looking for a little something from Kempo Sultan that I can bring into the class, but it's always very, very traditional, true Tibetan presentation that sometimes isn't quite as useful. In this case, he spends most of this, a whole page commentary, and most of it is about what they do with corpses in Tibet. He says, the fourth method was to feed the corpse to vultures. This act was performed to benefit the vultures because these birds do not kill to eat. They depend on carrion for their survival. Offering corpses to the vultures was thus regarded as an act of generosity. And then he says, one of the largest charnel grounds in Tibet was Saragompa, close to Lhasa. It was so busy that corpses were fed to the vultures every day. It is still like that. If you have the opportunity to visit Tibet, go to Saragompa. Watch how the body is cut into pieces and how the vultures come to eat. It is a good opportunity to meditate on impermanence. That would be an intense meditation. But we all, those of us who have the Chö empowerment, we also have some pretty intense visualizations, same thing. All right. So that's it. I urge everyone to reread this chapter, read the Dual Ornament on Impermanence, think about impermanence, but we're also going to move on to the next verse, which is about giving up negative friends. It is the last of the disentanglement verses, once we give up negative friends, and we're going to talk about what that means next week, it doesn't necessarily mean slamming the door in their face. We have to recognize when relationships are counterproductive to our Dharma aspirations, and then figure out how, you know, to not be influenced by that negatively. And that's something to think about this week is, and that's on the blog as well, the contemplation is, like, as you start to segue into the next verse, and you'll want to read the commentary for next week if you can, think about if you have some friends or acquaintances who fulfill this function for you. Like, they may be disrespectful of the Dharma, maybe they're Christian or atheist or whatever, and they think you're a nut for having a religion or for being Buddhist. Or people who distract you when you really need to get to your practice or think about Dharma. Or people who reinforce your behaviors that tend to dig you in deeper. Like, you want to go out for, you know, a drink. You want to eat this gallon of ice cream. Like, whatever it is, they reinforce your attachments and your addictions and your what we consider negative behaviors in Buddhism. Negative behaviors is not like a moral judgment. It's like negative behaviors are the ones that take you in the direction you don't want to go in. And think about, like, okay, first identify if you have any people like this in your life. And then think, next time they do that thing, how might I respond to it? And is it possible for me to continue to be friends with this person and interact with them and not be influenced by them, or do I need to take a break? These are things we can think about. And again, it's in the class notes, so you can look at that. I was going to chant a verse, like the verse 4 again, but we're really out of time, and we have a couple little housekeeping things to talk about. So let's just take a minute. I guess we'll do our prayer, and then we'll just do a little meditation. So let's do the dedication. Does anybody have anything to say? We do have a minute or two before we do the prayers. Yes, Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you. Okay.
I thought Ken McLeod's Give Up Your Life was, I would like to know whether the Tibetan had attachments in it. Give up, you know, let go. Ooh. The way you translated it was let go, not give up, which I like better.
It's the same word. The same word, it means, the same word is pongla in Tibetan. It means, can mean abandon it, it can mean give it up, it can mean shut the door on it, throw it away. It can also mean just refrain from it, don't engage in it.
But
there's
does
a spectrum.
Does the person have the word for attachments?
I'm sorry, what?
Let go of the attachments of this lifetime?
Yeah, let me just take a quick look. Yeah, attachment is the idea. I mean, Ken is being very sort of stark in how he expresses it. He wants to get your attention. Oops, that's not where that is.
Well, if this is too time consuming.
No, it's fine. It's just going to take a sec. It's old friends are right here. It is. Okay, so say di le tong. Jala say so this life le, what's le? Le is le tong. Tong means really to throw away, to like jettison it. There's not the word for attachment here. But it's what it means. It's always what it means. You know, we don't have to give up ice cream in Vajrayana Buddhism, but we just have to give up the idea that ice cream will make us happy in a permanent and lasting way. So we don't have to, like, give up our life literally. When Tibetans do put it that way, though, give up, you know, give up, it just means give up attachment to it.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right, I'm going to mute Marilyn again, and we will do our dedication prayers. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate.
the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. So we're going to just bring our minds to rest just for a minute, letting go of all thoughts that arise, letting them come, and just letting go of them and resting in awareness of the present moment, whatever the present moment holds, whether it's a busy mind or a quiet mind, pleasant or unpleasant, just resting in awareness.